It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So there's news about Facebook today. No, not the IPO. Did you hear General Motors isn't going to advertise on Facebook anymore? Said it's not worth the money. No, if you're Mark Zuckerberg, that is not good news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 15th of May. Glad you could be with us. And let's stipulate a couple of things about the looming Facebook IPO as we get going today, all right? One, there is a whole lot of hype going on here. Witness pretty much every news source you'll see or hear this week. Two, it's going to be crazy popular and not as cheap as we thought. There's so much demand from investors that the asking price has already gone up to somewhere between $34 and $38 a share. Used to be $28 to $35, you might recall. And three, really, what's all the fuss about? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports now on the Facebook skeptics.
Jason Raznick is a co-founder of Benzinga.com, a website that analyzes stocks. He's also a veteran investor who manages money with some friends. He's decided to sit out the Facebook IPO, to their chagrin.
So I have this investment group, and they're kind of mad at me.
But Raznick is sticking to his guns. He likes Facebook, but he thinks the company has an inflated sense of its own worth.
At $100 billion, you're talking about a very high valuation for Facebook.
At that price, Facebook would set a record for a company going public. Google was worth $23 billion on its IPO day. UPS, the current record holder, was worth $60 billion. Raznick sees other reasons to think Facebook is overpriced. The company's first quarter profit fell, and he doubts Mark Zuckerberg, the hoodie-wearing CEO, will satisfy Wall Street's thirst for profit.
He's going to run it more like a company where profit isn't the number one thing. It's going to be making the product the number one thing.
Oliver Porsche is the CEO of Gary Goldberg Financial Services. He refuses to even look at Facebook stock until a few days after the offering.
Yeah, it's going to be a madhouse for the first couple of days, in particular Friday, and that's not unusual. That's why you want to kind of take a step back and wait.
Kate Warren also wants investors to be careful. She's an investment strategist for Edward Jones, the brokerage.
If you're thinking about buying the shares, make sure you're not just being overwhelmed by the excitement you have using the product, because you need to think about whether the stock's going to go up, not based on the excitement.
That's why Raznick at Benzinga says facing his investment group's wrath is worth it.
It's dangerous when you get in these things. Everyone wants to get rich quick, and you think, hey, this is Facebook. If I can get it first, you think you're going to have a big home run. I don't think that's how it's going to be, and it hasn't been in the last 6 months with these tech IPOs.
Remember Groupon? Big buzz may be exciting, but it's not a great way to make a profit. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Caveat emptor, I believe, is the phrase. On Wall Street today, things closed lower than where they started. Blame the usual suspects. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a pretty stark gender gap in technology companies from the top all the way down through the ranks. And part of that is because women don't go into computer science at the same rate that men do. But another part of it is that because once they do go into it, women realize they don't like tech all that much. Not the work, the culture. Marketplace's Queen of Kim explains.
Meet the programmer. Part programmer, part fraternity brother. He used to be a geek. Now he's all about beers and chicks and the gym. Tasneem Raja is the interactive editor for Mother Jones Online.
Programmers are really macho. They have spiky hair. They drink a lot of cheap beer and bag the hottest girls.
Raja recently encountered the species at the South by Southwest Interactive Conference when she dropped into a session on how to get a job at a startup. It was by Matt Van Horn, the vice president for business development at the social network Path.
And so he's up there talking about this nudie calendar that he sent these guys at Dig.
Dig's the site where Van Horn got his first job.
And next he uses the word gangbang to describe an interview style.
Roger says at this point, a few women head to the door, but that doesn't deter Van Horn.
He told another story that was about how his fraternity's recruitment strategy was totally designed to help attract the hottest girls on campus.
Now Raja walks out and fires off this tweet.
Biz Dev VP of Path just cracked lame jokes about nudie calendars and gangbang, cue early exit.
The tweet gets retweeted and retweeted, and the responses fell into two camps. The outraged and a second group made up mostly of women in tech who said,
duh, I hear this all the time.
One of the problems with computer science is that you have this really homogenous group and no one's challenging each other.
That's Christy Nickel, a software engineer in Seattle.
Someone says, I thought it was funny, it's just a joke. The person next to him, who's probably a lot like him, says, oh yeah, it was just a joke. And they're like, oh, we must be right, we agree, and they move on, you know?
Maria Clave is the president of Harvey Mudd College, where she's pushing to get more women into computer science.
Especially in startups, you'll find that there are very few women and pretty male-centric culture.
How-centric? At last count, women made up 20% of programmers. Women in startups say that programmers have always existed in one form or another. What's different this time around is that the sexist comments once made to the bro at the next desk are now being blogged, put on discussion boards, and the social networks. Like this tweet from a programmer at Twitter. The tweet reads, learning how babies are made. And under it, a photo of his company's sexual harassment awareness and prevention pamphlet. Twitter declined to comment on the tweet. But Vic Schachter is an employment lawyer, and he says these situations can be tricky for social networks. After all, they practically exist to blur the lines between public and private.
These companies believe in a very open, frank communication. And in fact, in some cases, I've heard people say privacy, get over it.
As for the Path executive, the one who sent out the nudie calendar, he didn't get over his bro moment quite so easily. He ended up on CNN's website apologizing. And the news quickly made it to Twitter. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Jamie Dimon got some good news today, and he got some bad news. Today we'll do the bad first, I guess. There are reports that the Justice Department, the FBI in particular, has opened a preliminary criminal investigation into the trades that led to J.P. Morgan's $2 billion loss last week. The good news? Well, at the bank's annual meeting in Tampa, Florida today, shareholders voted to let Dimon keep his $23 million pay package from last year. But those directly involved in the trading debacle might not be so lucky. Dimon said the bank is going to consider clawbacks, that is, taking back salary and bonus payments from employees who made the mess. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
In the wake of the financial crisis, Congress created clawback provisions aimed at discouraging risky trading that could cause the biggest banks to fail. Wall Street banks have adopted their own clawback policies that go further. J.P. Morgan can cancel stock awards or demand they be repaid if an employee engages in conduct that causes material, financial, or reputational harm. New York City's top audit officer, Comptroller John Liu, pushed J.P. Morgan to adopt the policy. Now he says this is exactly the kind of case it was intended for.
When executives make wrong decisions or ill-advised decisions to perhaps pump up their own short-term pay at the expense of long-term value for the company, long-term investors such as the New York City pension funds get very concerned.
Clawbacks have been used only rarely since the financial crisis, and Paul Sabera says it's not clear they're appropriate in this case. He heads the New York-based executive search firm Alliance Consulting. He says the executives behind these trades had a good track record before they ran into trouble.
Even on the baseball field or the football field, you have people who are star athletes and commit errors. They make mistakes.
But New York City's comptroller says it's not fair when shareholders are the only ones who face the consequences. In fact, he thinks the banks need to toughen their clawback provisions.
Including not only the individuals that were directly responsible for the decision-making, but also their superiors.
Even Mr. Dimon in this case?
That's a decision for the board to make.
Most banking analysts consider that highly unlikely. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We saw this in Forbes today that Newt Gingrich sits at the top of the list of most indebted American politicians. He's $4.3 million in the hole. Legacy costs, you might say. Another part of the Gingrich legacy, though, is the attention he drew to private equity, most specifically to Mitt Romney's tenure at Bain Capital. And in so doing, Gingrich gave President Obama a model he has begun to use in the general campaign. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
A super PAC that backed Newt Gingrich got things started with an ad that attacked Bain Capital, the private equity company Mitt Romney co-founded.
For tens of thousands of Americans, the suffering began when Mitt Romney came to town.
That ad helped Gingrich win the South Carolina primary, and it gave President Obama grist for the general election. Yesterday, the Obama campaign released this ad about a steel plant Bain Capital took over in 1993 and tried to turn around. In 2001, that plant went bankrupt.
Bain Capital walked away with a lot of money that they made off of this plant. We view Mitt Romney as a job destroyer.
Ads like these haven't done much to help private equity's image. Steve Judge is the president and CEO of a trade group that represents 36 private equity firms.
Well, I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but I think that it actually provides us an opportunity.
To draw attention to when private equity has helped failing companies. That's something the Romney campaign is also trying to do. President Obama may continue to attack Romney's ties to private equity, but Stephen Davidoff, a finance professor at The Ohio State University, says he has to be careful.
Well, it's where the money is, right?
And President Obama needs to fundraise. Last night, he collected more than $1 million at a fundraiser hosted by Tony James, an executive with another private equity firm, Blackstone. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Just to follow up on that list, number two on the list of politicians in debt, Lyndon LaRouche. Had to remind myself today when it was that he ran. Turns out, every cycle from 1976 to 2004, if you can believe that. Back in the salad days of the housing boom, a home, as you might have heard, was as good as a cash machine. People taking equity out to pay for lavish renovations and flat-screen TVs and new cars. But a study out this week says a lot of low- and middle-income families did something else with that money. They sent their kids to better colleges than they could otherwise afford. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Take a kid who was 12 years old in 1997. By the time she was ready to start college, the family home would have appreciated by more than $72,000 on average, and banks were practically giving away second mortgages and home equity loans.
The idea is that when this equity became easier to tap, families were extracting that equity to help cover the cost of these schools that were more selective and more prestigious, but also higher cost.
Michael Lovenheim is an assistant professor at Cornell University and co-author of the study published by the National Bureau of Economic Research this week. He says for every $10,000 jump in home prices, students were more likely to attend flagship public universities and less likely to go to community college. And he says choosing a more selective college pays off.
Those students tend to graduate quicker, they're more likely to graduate, and they have significantly higher earnings.
It's easy to guess what's happened since the recession and the collapse of the housing market. In 2004, Dean Nimmer took out a home equity loan to help send his son to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Since then, his home value has fallen by half.
I think for many, many people, the notion of your home being a way to leverage paying for really important expenses and actually moving up is pretty much gone.
Nimmer says he still would have sent his son to UMass, but he may have had to take out expensive private student loans. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, see the ball, Noonan. Be the ball.
You know, these games have kind of been taken away from us in a way, or, you know, we're kind of outsourcing play to these high-priced teams and players.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, we had the happy music all queued up, and then this happened. The Dow Industrial's down 63 points today, 0.5%, 12,632. The NASDAQ slid 8 points, 3-tenths percent, 28.93. At the bell, the S&P 500 down 7 points. That's a 0.5%, 13.30 is the number. After 5 days' worth of bad news, J.P. Morgan Chase rebounded 1.25%. Today, Goldman Sachs picked up a 10th percent. Citigroup, though, withdrew 1.25%. TJX, the discount retailer that owns TJ Maxx and Marshalls, racked up a 7% gain. Dick's Sporting Goods shot up 6% after posting a big spike in monthly profits. Macy's joined the parade with nearly a 1% bump. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note was 1.77%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for April. The Federal Reserve releases its monthly industrial production report. And in France, the curtain goes up on the Cannes Film Festival. This year, in the Cannes Classics program, a shark chews the scenery. Jaws will be screened. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. And from our desk of, that's not a good omen. Today, this news. The brand new president of France, François Hollande, was on his way to Berlin today for a meeting with Angela Merkel, minding his own business, flying along the presidential plane when it was hit by lightning. He did get there eventually. The meeting did happen, if a little bit late. Not a good start to arguably the most important economic relationship in Europe. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
François Hollande was sworn in as the new French president this morning with all the pomp and national pride that France can muster. But within hours, he was flying off to Berlin to meet Europe's real power and paymaster.
Die deutsch-französische Kooperation ist essentiell für Europa.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she welcomed the new French president with open arms, but the two leaders do not agree over the best way to tackle the Eurozone debt crisis. Hollande has called for Europe's new treaty promoting budget discipline to be renegotiated, but German lawmaker and Merkel ally Peter Altmaier says that cannot happen.
We are profoundly convinced that this policy that was signed up by 25 member states is the only way out of the crisis.
And he dismisses Hollande's idea that Europe should borrow more to invest and therefore grow its way out of trouble.
We cannot solve a sovereign debt crisis by allowing an even higher deficit.
All this is rather tricky for the new French president. He won the election promising a new, more expansive approach to the crisis. Paul Vallée is with the Sciences Po University in Paris.
It will be very difficult for him to turn to his electorate and say that he couldn't deliver what he promised. Within a week of the election, it's a very dire start.
Of course, Hollande won't make any such admission, and Angela Merkel will make it easy for him, talking about the importance of investment to get the European economy growing again, while still insisting on budget belt-tightening. And, says Paul Vallée, Hollande can always fall back on his formidable political skills.
Some people have nicknamed him the eel for his capacity to wiggle out of a difficult spot with some kind of choice formula. He's going to have to put that talent to work here.
In the wake of his victory, there has been talk of Hollande leading a pro-growth, anti-austerity group of Eurozone countries, including Greece, and ganging up on Germany. A Greek myth, says German commentator Heinz Schulte.
If they believe that France will lead a southern sort of rebellion against the Germans, then that could end up in a deep Greek tragedy, because that is not going to happen.
He says that France and Germany are too entwined. They must remain in lockstep. And just as Merkel merged with the previous French leader to become Merkozy, a new entity is now stalking Europe, Merkeland. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's a natural temptation, what with all the economic gloom and doom in Europe, once and again, to look to Asia for a little cheering up. Yeah, no, that's not going to happen. Best guesses had been that the Chinese economy would pick itself up and shake off the slump it's been in. But then the numbers came out last week showing everything from industrial production to housing to domestic spending was off. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai.
While economists were making grand and incorrect predictions about China's economic rebound, CLSA economist Andy Rothman was eager about something else.
What I've been waiting to see is, are they willing to cool off the growth rate of spending on public infrastructure at a point when it's clear that they've already built so much of it, and that's starting to happen this year. And in fact, it's the main reason the Chinese economy is slowing down.
And that, says Rothman, is a good thing for an economy that's been addicted to constructing new roads, buildings, and high-speed trains to boost GDP growth.
This is, in my view, the Communist Party saying we're not going to build bridges if they're not really needed.
As China spends less on infrastructure, it may spend more on health care and other social programs that'll have a more direct impact on people's pocketbooks. That, in turn, could help boost the consumption of products from brands like KFC, Apple, and GM, all American companies that are already showing record profits in China. But William Hess, director of PRC Macro Advisors, says slower growth in China is a looming threat.
The U.S. And the Obama administration wants to boost exports to China. Now, if China is facing a shortage of domestic demand, especially in areas like capital goods, where they want to themselves become globally competitive exporters.
Then, says Hess, U.S. companies will face stiffer competition from Chinese brands. But on the upside, U.S. exports to China have grown 540% since China entered the WTO 11 years ago. U.S. export growth to the rest of the world during the same period, 80%. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Whether you kick it or pitch it, if you catch it or throw it or dribble it or hit it, the ball is the common denominator in our sporting lives today, us regular folk and high-salary professionals as well. It defines the games that we play and how we play them. Author John Fox, though, wanted to figure out why. His new book is called The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game.
Play is a way that we learn about the world as young people, and it actually shapes our brains and develops our cognition so we can interact in the world around us.
Explain that a little bit. Is it as simple as having the hand-eye coordination to catch a ball with a glove?
Yeah, a lot of the studies actually are done with animals because, of course, anybody that's played ball with a dog knows that animals play just as much as we do, especially mammals. You know, one of the things that was interesting is that we spent a few days just playing with dolphins, basically, down in Florida. The dolphins are swimming around the pool, and I grab a ball, and I throw it in the water, and the dolphin smacks the ball out with his beak, and it lands at my feet. So I throw it back in, and then he knocks it out of the pool again. So suddenly we had this sophisticated game that kind of changed incrementally as we played.
There's a historical continuity, I guess, that sports brings to us as well. And you point out that the people in that Ohio factory that make the footballs for the NFL, they're doing the same basic thing with that piece of leather that people did in Ireland in 1850 or whatever.
Yes, we went to the Wilson Football Factory in Ada, Ohio. You've got about 150 people working the line there, and it's really pretty simple technology. It's like not that different than a cobbler's shop, only it's kind of automated. You know, that little factory in Ada, Ohio produces every NFL football and have since 1955. So, you know, it's changed, but not that much.
I wonder if in the course of reporting this book, did it ever make you sad that the ball and the object of the game and the play has become such big business and that grown-ups have essentially taken it over.
Absolutely. Kind of the backdrop of this was that feeling that, you know, these games have kind of been taken away from us in a way, or, you know, we're kind of outsourcing play to these high-priced teams and players. And meanwhile, kids are playing outdoors less and less. And part of this book was really to reclaim that sort of innocent, pure connection to the roots of these games and why we care so much and should care about them.
It's sort of the age we live in, right? We're not playing with ball so much as electrons and pixels depicting a ball on a screen.
An interesting study came out that showed that when you're watching sports, there's about 20% of the same neurons that fire while you're playing that fire while you're watching that game. So you actually have your brain in the game, and you do derive some cognitive kind of benefit, but there's still an 80% difference. And then there's the 100% difference of physical activity that kids aren't getting. So I think there's a gap there.
John Fox, his book is called The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
There's an excerpt of The Ball on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which the apocalypse really is upon us. We read this morning, and this actually happened, that Virgin Atlantic is going to start allowing in-flight cell phone calls on some of its transatlantic routes, New York to London.
This is your captain speaking. Please shut off all cell phones and other electronic devices, except you in rows 1 through 6. Your time begins now.
You will be charged £2 per minute to place this satellite call.
Really?
Hey, honey, guess where I am? That's right.
John?
I think it's like a sat phone.
Just got word.
Don't forget to feed Freddy.
Yes, I'm in the air now.
Okay.
Great.
Love you.
We'll catch up in a few hours.
Whew. Okay, not so bad.
You not believe the ugly baby is on this flight. I mean, do you...
Did she really
half
say
an hour
that?
And the doctor finally comes in and he tells me I have hemorrhoids and I'm like, oh my God.
Oh, girl.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Like I said, the apocalypse, courtesy of the Marketplace players. Yeah. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow slipped 63 points, 0.5%, finished at 12,632. The NASDAQ off 8 points. The S&P 500 down 7 points. That's about 0.5%. Thanks to Mary Dew, Justin Ho, and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.